c'est pas facile. Il y a une amende à payer.
أهلي أكيد إذا عرفوا إنه أنا قلبت من مسلمة لمسيحية فأكيد رح يكون الجزاء تبعي هو الموت يعني.
They push me. They will, you know, give me hard time. You know, I was crying. I would go to my on the roof and I was wondering, asking the Lord, why me?
Then some voice in my mind came and says, don't think that you are alone. I'm with you always.
There are many thousands in the country, live in their villages, they are hidden, they're secret believers, and nobody knows about them.
My big brother called me. He asked me, are you a Muslim anymore? Here I can't lie. I said, no. And he started insulting and you have to come home now, and I will call you, I have to kill you, and okay, I keep calm. I said, okay, God bless you, I will come back. So I came back home. He asked me, you believe in Muhammad, that he's a prophet? I said, no. He told me, take off your glass. He came to beat me. His head stopped here, and his knee, he stopped it here. He can't. He said he wants to beat me, but he can't. I told him, can I do something? And you have right to stop me, but I want to do it. He said, what? I just stand and I hug him. He didn't understand that I love them and I have to love them. Even they now they think that I'm a bad girl, and I love them in our case. And Jesus said, if I receive hate or evil, and I respond with evil, the evil will never end. But if I receive bad things with good things, it can end.
Je disais, mon Dieu, que soit votre volonté, c'est-à-dire.
I need prayer for to stay strong.
I want you to pray that people will experience what I was talking about. The special experience with God. The good news can change your life. Tell them the good news and they will be saved.
You know, we're in the middle of a series regarding the seven letters written to the seven churches in Asia Minor and found in the book of Revelation. And it's on the island of Patmos that Jesus appeared to John with a vision that mapped out the end time. This final book of the Bible is known as the Revelation of Jesus Christ. The book begins by revealing the heart of Jesus for those he's left behind. With seven letters again to seven churches along the borders of what we now know as modern Turkey. Revelation chapter 1, verse 10 says, suddenly I heard behind me a loud voice like a trumpet blast. It said, write in a book everything you see and send it to the seven churches in the cities of Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea. And as you can see from the map, they fall along the western border of what is now known as Turkey. In fact, it was a postal route, if you will. It was a Roman road that allowed the various communities to talk with each other, to trade with each other. And along that road, church plants began, starting with the church of Ephesus that Paul visited. And then church plants began again on throughout that road to all of these churches and beyond. Well, not form letters. Each of these letters do follow the same format. There's a recipient. Usually it says to the angel of the church, and then it's followed by the name of that congregation. And there's a recognition of the church's current condition. It'll start out with Jesus saying, I know, or, but I have this against you. Then there's a response with an admonition from Jesus as to that very church and to the churches and individuals who face those situations. and a reward, a promise of what the future holds for those who are faithful to him, and a reminder for all the rest of us. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. That's in every single one of the letters. And it's that last part that is the reason for this series of messages. Let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. For what Jesus wrote to the Christians of those early churches was certainly meant for them. It was meant to encourage them and lift them up and to admonish them and correct them in things if needed. But he also wrote them for us as well. He wrote them for every Christian through every age from that date, those dates forward. And on this 7-week journey together, we'll be considering each of the 7 churches. We'll be looking at each of the first century churches, what they look like, what they faced, the message the congregation received, and most importantly for us, the relevance of those messages, those instructions to us today. And today our journey takes us to the second church mentioned. That's the church in Smyrna. Now, Ephesus was last week. You may recall Jesus said, you've lost your first love. We could call that the careless church. Well, if that's true, then another word we could use for Smyrna is the crowned church. Here was a church that endured great suffering and persecution. But Jesus gave them, and he gave us, some great advice on how to deal with suffering. So let's look at the parts of the letter, verse by verse here. The recipient, first of all, Revelation 2, verse 8. Write this letter to the angel of the church in Smyrna. This is the message from the one who is the first and the last, who was dead but is now alive. Smyrna is in a location that we now call Izmir. It's one of two of the letters were written to churches in cities that still exist today. And one of them is Smyrna, or Izmir as it's called, about 35 miles north of Ephesus on the Aegean Sea. It was called the Glory of Asia because it was so beautiful. It was filled with multiple temples to various pagan gods. It was the birthplace of the poet Homer. Had a library that had many volumes of books. It was home to a famous stadium that hosted various Grecian Olympic games and gladiators. There's a small Christian church even today there in that area. They do not face the persecution of a Caesar. Now instead they have to be aware of Islamic attackers, but there is a Christian church still in that community. Smyrna was the source for much of the world's myrrh. In fact, the name Smyrna comes from the word myrrh. Myrrh was a spice that when crushed released a beautiful aroma. You may recall that is in the time of Jesus' burial, that it was used for burial to wrap up a body to help fragrance around the dead body. But it's interesting and odd or ironic because here the Christians are being crushed and they too are lifting off a beautiful fragrance to the Lord. Smyrna was not a friendly place to be if you were a Christian. In fact, in all of Asia Minor, Smyrna was probably the worst place a Christian could live. Cicero called Smyrna one of Rome's most faithful allies. Throughout the Roman Wars, they sided with Rome each and every time and were duly noted and rewarded for that. And Smyrna proved its loyalty to Rome by erecting several temples in honor of Roman gods. There was even an altar dedicated and honoring Caesar, where once a year every citizen was expected to come, burn incense, and declare Caesar is Lord. And after their incense was burnt, the offerer was issued a token. Now anyone refusing to acknowledge Caesar as Lord was excluded from the trades, could not work, and was denied a token, which meant certain unemployment and poverty. But to declare Caesar as Lord would be a heresy for the Christians in that town. So they refused to do it and they were persecuted and left without means of supporting themselves. If you'd been a Christian there, you'd have faced constant insults, constant mistreatments. You would have struggled to make a living. Few would be willing to hire you. Your children would be targets for bullies. You'd have lived in danger of losing what little possessions you had. You would have faced the prospect of imprisonment and more probable death. Jesus says here he's the first and the last. That's an Old Testament title for God and affirms Jesus' equality in nature with God. He is God, the first and the last. He's the eternal, infinite God who already existed when all things were created and who will continue to exist after they are destroyed. Jesus Christ transcends time and space and all of creation. He said it again at the very last chapter of Revelation. Very last chapter of the Bible, Revelation 22, verse 12. Look, I'm coming soon, bringing my reward with me to repay all people according to their deeds. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last, the beginning and the end. Blessed are those who wash their robes. They will be permitted to enter through the gates of the city and eat the fruit from the tree of life. And now he goes into the recognition portion. Verse 9. I know about your suffering and your poverty, but you are rich. I know the blasphemy of those opposing you. They say they're Jews, but they're not, because their synagogues belong to Satan. Now, all of the seven churches but one had a praise, and all but two had a condemnation. And here we have no condemnation. Ephesus, if you may remember last week, I've seen your hard work, I've seen your patient endurance, but I have this one complaint against you. You've lost your first love. Notice here, however, there's no condemnation at all. There's no condemnation mentioned. Only two of the seven churches, Smyrna, and we'll see later Philadelphia. And ironically, they're also the only two churches that exist to this day. It's fair to say the Smyrna was probably not a perfect church. However, God took note of the trials that they continually experienced, commending them for standing firm in the face of real pressure. Jesus first recognizes their works. And even while undergoing intense persecution, they're still faithful to do good works for the Lord and others. And then Jesus says he notices three sources of their trouble. First, suffering. The congregation in Smyrna is experiencing suffering, or other translations call it tribulation. And unlike congregations in North America, this congregation truly suffered. The church of Smyrna had much in common with our sister congregations today that are located in Syria or Afghanistan or Iraq, Iran, Indonesia, the Philippines. Tragically, this congregation may have much in common what will face the church in America someday as well. We in the United States have been spared intense opposition. We don't really know what it means to be persecuted. We call ourselves the persecuted church. But as you saw in that video, we're a far cry from what others in the true persecuted church experience. We read of fellow believers being persecuted, some even to death, but the account somehow seems distant. It seems unreal. Certainly, it should have no impact on us. Sadly, Christians persecuted in Afghanistan and Iraq and Iran and Syria, Saudi Arabia, somehow don't stir us to compassion. The persecution of our brothers and sisters in Indonesia and Pakistan and India, they don't leave us with a sense of sorrow. Have we forgotten the admonition of Romans chapter 5, where it said, rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep? Secondly, Jesus takes note then of their poverty. He uses a very strong word to speak about poverty. The word doesn't speak of need, as we might consider some in poverty today, but of destitution. It often was used to describe beggars who lived not by their own work, but only by the gifts of others. Perhaps these saints had experienced plundering of what they did own. Christianity was not legally permitted. It was easy for others to take advantage of those who would follow Christ. Property can be plundered, but no one can plunder the soul of the child of God. As the writer of the letter to Hebrew Christians penned that letter, he urges his readers, chapter 10, verse 32, think back on those early days when you first learned about Christ. Remember how you remained faithful, even though it meant terrible suffering. Sometimes you were exposed to public ridicule and were beaten. Sometimes you helped others who were suffering the same things. You suffered along with those who were thrown into jail, and when all you owned was taken from you, accepting it with joy. You knew there were better things waiting for you that will last forever. So do not throw away this confident trust in the Lord. Remember the great reward it brings you. Patient endurance is what you need now, so that you will continue to do God's will. And then you will receive all that he has promised. The lasting example of one's life is not measured by the wealth we may have accumulated. Wealth can be a blessing, but it can also be a curse. As people are devoted to what the wealth can buy rather than thinking of what wealth can mean as a way of honoring God. Wealth is not an indicator of spiritual power or divine blessing, as some churches might preach. Indeed, wealth and treasure may indicate a moral decline, the loss of spiritual stamina, spiritual death even. Christ goes on and says, but you are rich. The church in Smyrna was the rich, poor church, if you will, in contrast to the church at Laodicea, which was the poor, rich church. Friends, I encourage you, don't run from the troubles of life. Embrace Jesus all the more. He is here with us. He's here with you, and you are richer than you think. And Thirdly, Jesus noticed in the church of Smyrna, he noted the slander, the blasphemia the saints endured. Because Christians were despised and marginalized, they seemed like a virus, a disease that needed to be removed. And because of this, the Jews there found an outlet for their rage against the followers of Christ. And so accusations were thrown at them. We know of several, seven, in fact, and there may be more, but seven accusations brought against early Christians. They were accused of cannibalism because in their communion, Jesus had said, "This is my body, this is my blood." They were accused of incest. They spoke of brothers and sisters in the Lord, and they greeted each other with a holy kiss. They were accused of having terrible orgies because Christians had love feast and they gathered together and they eat and fellowship and rejoice in the Lord. Christians were accused of tampering with family relationships, and Christianity did, in fact, as we noted in this film, often split families when some members became Christians. Christians were accused of being atheists. And that's a hard one to think about, but who can understand a worship which had no image of the God that they worship? Without an image, how can you know who you're worshiping? Christians were accused of being politically disloyal because they wouldn't say that Caesar is Lord, and therefore they were political traitors. And lastly, Christians were accused of being anarchists because they foretold the end of the world was going to be in flames. But notice, neither the Romans or the Jews are the source of their problems. Who is it? It's the devil. The words that are recorded may appear harsh, especially when the master speaks of Jews as a synagogue of Satan. The Lord is exposing them as a gathering, not God's people, as a gathering as Satan's people. For Satan is exposed in the Bible as the accuser of our brothers. And it's easy for us to become so focused on the individuals who seek to injure Christ's faithful people, we forget who we are, who's against us, and what we're charged to do. But if we're to resist the enemy, we have to first acknowledge who the enemy actually is. Peter said in 1 Peter 5, verse 8, "Stay alert, watch out for your great enemy, the devil. He prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour." The Apostle Paul echoed this thought in his letter to the church at Ephesus. In Ephesians 6, verse 10, "A final word, be strong in the Lord and in his mighty power. Put on all of God's armor so you'll be able to stand firm against all strategies of the devil. For we are not fighting against flesh and blood enemies, but against evil rulers and authorities of the unseen world, against mighty powers in this dark world, and against evil spirits in the heavenly places. Therefore, put on every piece of God's armor so you'll be able to resist the enemy in the time of evil. And then after the battle, you'll be standing firm." See, Christians around the globe do not battle against communists, although communism stands opposed to our faith. Neither do we battle against despots or dictators, though they are intent on subjugating us. We're not battling Islamic zealots, though many Muslims are intent on erasing Christianity off the earth. We're not battling evil government bureaucrats who would silence Christianity if they can't co-opt them. No, we realize that behind every human opponent we may face, behind every persecution that's unleashed on us in this fallen world, is the dark, blood-stained hands of Satan, that evil being who stands opposed to all that is righteousness. So persecution, poverty, slander of blasphemous words. No, the church in Smyrna would never attract the attention of the rich and the famous today. Brides would not be fighting for the opportunity to have their wedding conducted by the pastor there in the church in Smyrna. Those who wish to give their loved ones a Christian burial would never consider that little church in Smyrna. The church in Smyrna wouldn't be able to afford to televise their services today, and even if they were able to do so, few people would be willing to even watch. I suppose it's human nature for all of us to want to be associated with success, right? We find meaning for our existence through our affiliation with that which is significant in the eyes of others. We find meaning for our lives through the influence we wield and the way we're able to make the world sit up and take notice to what we are and what we're doing. We want to believe that God blesses the church we attend so that we'll be a part of what's seen as influential, so that people around us will respect us. There's a tendency for churchgoers to choose the congregation they will attend not on whether God's word is faithfully presented from the pulpit, but on the basis of the building, the pews, the children's programming, the extracurricular activities available on campus. whether the building has padded pews and plush carpeting, whether the congregation uses a paid worship band or boasts a huge choir behind the podium. And Christ now gives his response, Revelation 2:10. Don't be afraid of what you're about to suffer. The devil will throw some of you into prison to test you, and you will suffer for 10 days. Don't be afraid of what you're about to suffer. I mean, they've already suffered a lot. That's why they're getting this letter. It wasn't even over yet. More was to come. Oh, yay. It's like a hurricane. When you're in the eye of the hurricane, half of the battle is over. But guess what? The other half is now to come. You will suffer for 10 days. Now, a lot of different commentators, for almost as many commentators as there are different ideas of what this means. But it's possible they only suffered for 10 more 24-hour days. I'm not sure that was the case. But some say possibly it's an allusion to Daniel chapter 1, where you may remember that Daniel and his friends were tested for 10 days. Others, the persecution under Diocletian, which was the emperor at the time, lasted exactly 10 years. So maybe that's what it meant. But I think it much more likely these were the 10 seasons of time that they were about to face. And indeed, history records 10 major persecutions of the early church. If you're familiar with the work Fox's Book of Martyrs, it archived so many thousands of Christian believers that lost their lives to martyrdom. First was Nero. Thousands of Christians were killed. Paul was beheaded. He used to take the Christians and put them in wax and then tie them to trees and light them afire as candles for his gardens. There was Domitian. This is the one where John was boiled in oil and banished to Patmos, the one in the current times where we're reading. There was Trajan. Ignatius was martyred. Eustatius was a Roman centurion, who, when told that he had to bow and say that Caesar is Lord, wouldn't do it. So he and his family were murdered. Then Marcus Aurelius, Polycarp, a famous leader of the church at the time. He was the bishop of Smyrna. He was also a disciple of John. He was martyred at this point. When they put him on the stake, they started to tie him to it. And he said, don't tie me. I'll stay here. I'll stay where I am because I'm committed to this. They said, look, if you will just renounce Jesus, just say Caesar's Lord, just say those words, Caesar is Lord, and we'll release you. And this was his quote. He said, 86 years have I served him, and he never once wronged me. How then shall I blaspheme my king who hath saved me? Severus, in AD 193, Irenaeus, who was a disciple of Polycarp, who again was a disciple of John, he was beheaded in the term of Maximus. Christians were killed without trial. They were buried indiscriminately. We see images now of some places in the Middle East, for instance, where you'll see entire pits filled with bodies. No names, no services, just filled with bodies. And that's what happened back then. And then Decius, told to sacrifice to false gods or you would be tortured to death, every single one of you. Some even recanted after that torture. And then they were soon to die after that even. Valerian, in Carthage, the city of Carthage, a terrible plague broke out and they blamed it on the Christians. And so there was an edict that all Christians would be put to death that did not partake in the sacrifices to the gods. Aurelian, interesting timing here, on September 22 of 286 AD, so we know the date that it actually happened, there was a legion of Roman soldiers, the Theban Legion. It's from the land of Thebes, where they came from, with 6,666 men. They refused an oath of allegiance, and they refused to swear to exterminate Christians in the land of Gaul. And for that, Aurelian had every 10th soldier executed right in front of all the other soldiers. He asked again, will you swear allegiance? They declined one more time. Again, every 10th soldier was killed in front of them. And again, he asked, will you swear allegiance? Finally, the entire legion was taken out by other soldiers simply because they would swear allegiance only to Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior. And finally, Diocletian, he had four edicts. Those edicts, churches would be destroyed. The scriptures would be burned. Leaders would be imprisoned. And the leaders who would not sacrifice suffered extreme torture. So there were 10 periods of time in the Roman Empire where there were all of these persecution from these leaders. Then Jesus mentions the reward. John continues, though, in verse 10. But if you remain faithful, even when facing death, I will give you the crown of life. Now, the church in Smyrna was facing an incredible persecution. People were murdered simply because they were believers, and it didn't stop there. Do you know that more Christians have been killed for their faith in the last 100 years than in all the time since Jesus Christ walked this earth? There's estimated to be 50 to 70,000 Christians in prison in North Korea right now. And the Cornell College had a study that shows that on average, 171,000 Christians are killed for their faith each and every year around the globe. The Olympics were reportedly a big deal to those living in Smyrna, and they knew the winner would be presented with a crown of life. And of course, Christians in Smyrna could never dream of receiving one of these crowns. And yet Jesus is saying all the faithful will receive the crown of life. Throughout the New Testament, there are hosts of crowns that are given to those who are faithful. The crown of glory for the faithful pastor. Crown of righteousness for those who live a godly life. The crown of life for those who are faithful in testing. The crown of rejoicing for those who win people to the Lord. And the incorruptible crown for those who finish their course for the glory of God. So why this suffering? Why do we have to endure all this suffering? Because we live in a world tainted by sin, a world often filled with hate and selfishness. And there's a special hatred for Christ and his church and his people that can only be described as satanic. But there's four types of sufferings in this world that we might experience. And we often ask to have suffering removed from us, but God often allows the difficulty to remain for a specific purpose, a greater purpose, if you will. So there's four types of suffering. First is counterfeit suffering. That's the complainers, the pessimists. Woe is me. I missed that signal. I got to go all the way around again. I'm being persecuted for my faith. How to deal with that kind of suffering? Avoid it at all costs. Philippians 2 says, do everything without complaining and arguing so that no one can criticize you. Live clean, innocent lives as children of God, shining like bright lights. James 5:9 says, don't grumble about each other, brothers and sisters, or you will be judged. The second kind of suffering is corrective suffering. It's a suffering as a result of our own actions, suffering for our wrong choices. When we mess up and fall into sin, our Heavenly Father disciplines. How do we deal with that kind of suffering? Try to avoid that as well. We need to learn from our mistakes, accept the consequences, try to correct them if possible, and move on. And if it's a sin issue, then we need to accept responsibility for it. We need to confess it. We need to seek forgiveness and accept God's discipline without blaming others. Thirdly, there's a cultural suffering. Sometimes our suffering is not because of anything we've done. It's just the consequences of living in a cursed, fallen culture or world. John 16:33 says, I have told you all this so you may have peace in me. Here on earth, you will have many trials and sorrows, but take heart because I have overcome the world. Is it right that so many have suffered and died from COVID? No. Is it right that women or children are abused on a regular basis? No. How do we deal with this kind of suffering? We have to endure it. I can't understand how unbelievers deal with this stuff. They have no hope, no answer, no one to really lean on. But we have an advocate. We have an anchor, a source of strength. We have a shield. Jesus knows our pain. He's been there. And he's here for each one of us now. Hebrews 13:4 quotes him saying, never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. See, Jesus never promised to keep us from the storms, but he did promise to keep us through the storms we experience. And fourthly, there's Christian suffering. Suffering because you're a Christian, like the Christians there in the city of Smyrna. Again, this kind of suffering is inevitable for believers. It's a battle out there, whether we realize it or not. And it's a battle we cannot win in our own strength. How do we deal with that kind of suffering? We need to embrace it. That sounds strange, to embrace suffering. But we need to get in there and fight in his strength and in his armor. We need to fight the good fight. I read of a woman who had grown up in the old Soviet Union. And in a Christian conference, she shared the faith of Russian Christians during those dark and bleak days. She described the terror as the believers met for worship, the dangers inherent in gathering in the forest to pray, to sing and hear a passage or read a message from the Word. Every wedding, every birthday, every funeral became an occasion to declare the message of Christ. She spoke of the cost that so many paid, even to the point of losing worldly possessions and incarceration that included hard labor. And then she shared the most amazing words of all, as the tears were streaming down her face. I miss it so much. How could anyone miss such opposition, such danger, such pressure? How could she miss all that? And the woman continued, because the prayers were so real and the worship was so sincere. There was the answer. She didn't miss the persecution. She missed the spiritual life of the church that was involved at that time. She concluded by saying that much of what she observed, sadly, of the life of the church here in North America was artificial, lacking sincerity, too often a mere ritual that's offered up without any passion whatsoever. Sadly, I believe she was speaking a truth few of us are prepared to hear, but must hear. We're to live our lives more abundantly, no matter what the devil might send our way. And then Jesus follows up with his reminder to all of us. Revelation 2:11, anyone with ears to hear must listen to the Spirit and understand what he's saying to the churches. Whoever is victorious will not be harmed by the second death. Praise God. The first death is a physical death, separates the soul from the body. But the second death is a separation of the soul and spirit from the presence of the Lord forever. Further on in Revelation 26, it says, blessed and holy are those who share in that first resurrection. For them, the second death holds no power, but they will be priests of God and of Christ and will reign with him 1,000 years. To the church in Smyrna, to believers everywhere, including us here at Maranatha, Jesus is saying, don't give up. Hang in there. This too shall pass. And most importantly, the future will be infinitely better than the present is right now. Let us pray.